Okay, good morning, all.
Good morning.
Welcome to our breakfast in the base class on the Torah, Life, and Thought of the Chassam Sofer. Before we begin, I just have to apologize because obviously you can hear my voice, and I basically have lost my voice. We're still going to try to get through it and do this. But I apologize ahead of time if I don't sound with my, if I don't have my regular robust voice. We're speaking about the Chassam Sofer today. We'll just jump right in. So the Chassam Sofer was not his name. His mom didn't call him Chassam Soferla, right? They called him by an actual name. His name was Moshe. Rabbi Moshe Sofer was his name. Truth be told, his name wasn't even Sofer. It was actually Schreiber. Schreiber is the German translation of Sofer. It means scribe. His father was a scribe. So Rabbi Moshe Sofer, or Rabbi Moshe Schreiber, was born on September 24th, 1762, on the 7th of Tishrei, 5523, in the middle of Aseres Mitzvah. He was known as the Chassam Sofer. That's what we call him, that because of his work, right? He called his work the Chassam Sofer, aka it's an acronym for Chidushei Toras Moshe, right? Chidushei Chet Tav Mem, Chidushei Toras Moshe Sofer. So that's why it's called the Chassam Sofer, and that's why we refer to him as the Chassam Sofer. He comes from a very, very special family. His parents were Reizel and Reb Shmuel Sofer. His parents tried to have children for many, many years. They were not able to have children until finally one year. The way the story goes is that Reb Seligman, who was a rav in the community, one of the more significant figures in Frankfurt, where they were living, on Tainus Esther one year, he comes to their house, to the Schreiber, to the Sofer household. He knocks on the door and he says, just so you know, you're going to have a child this year. What do you know? They actually did have a child that year after so many years of waiting. If you want to get a sense of the type of family that he had and who his parents were, let's take a look at source number one. Source number one on page two over here, it tells the following story. It sounds so unbelievable, but the truth is I saw it listed in so many places, or I had heard of it in so many different places, that you have to assume that it's true. So let's take a look at what the story says in source number one. 7 months later, on a Friday during the Aseres Mitzvah, 36-year-old Reizel Sofer experienced the pains of childbirth for the first time. It was late in the day, the sun beginning its descent, and the child's cries had not yet been heard. So in other words, this is Erev Shabbos, Shabbos Shuva. Reizel was distressed, but not from the anxiety, pain, or the long, drawn-out process. She was worried about being the cause of Chilul Shabbos, right? So just a quick Chilul Shabbos lesson, just so you aren't misled by this. In short, whenever a person has a child on Shabbos, as Hallie probably could tell you better than me, right? So you do whatever you need to do to get the woman to the doctor. But she was concerned because she didn't want to have to be Mechal Shabbos in any way, so she really wanted the child to be born before Shabbos. In the great shul of Frankfurt, Erev Shabbos Mincha had concluded. The lamps were all lit and the tables covered in white in honor of the arriving queen. The shul seemed to shine as the kehillah prepared to receive the Shabbos. Okay, that's how they write in art school biographies. But there was a delay. Kehillah members looked on with interest as a messenger hurried in and made his way to the Rav. Frankfurt's revered Rav, Rav Abishal, listened intently to the request sent by Reizel Sofer. The Rav was familiar with the woman. She was known in Frankfurt as Reizel Tzadekes because of her commitment to helping Talmidei Chachamim and impoverished families by collecting and distributing funds. And now, Reizel, who had given so much to the people of Frankfurt, was asking a favor of her own. She wanted the Kehillah to wait a bit longer before accepting the Shabbos so that the birth of her child might take place without desecrating the holy day. So it's a bit of a weird request. You think whenever Shabbos comes, it comes. Who has the right to say that push off Shabbos? So the answer seems to be that they were probably having early Shabbos, right? So it was early Shabbos, and then she said, don't accept early Shabbos, wait a little bit longer, accept Shabbos Bizman at the right time, so that I can therefore have this child before Shabbos, right? The general rule is that whenever the community accepts Shabbos, that's when everyone has to accept Shabbos if there's no other dissenting opinion. So she said, wait to accept Shabbos so that I too won't have to accept Shabbos, and then I can have the kid before Shabbos. The Rav agreed. Right, so it just gives you a sense of the kind of person and the kind of people that they were, that the Rav was willing to wait for this woman to have before she had the child to accept Shabbos, and they would wait a bit longer. Some of the Kehillah members were surprised. Why would the Rav hold off accepting Shabbos because of the request of a lone woman? Rabbi Abishal turns to the people. The child who would be born, he exclaimed, would be worthy of the wait, a person who would illuminate the eyes of scholars with his Torah and bring relief to his nation through his tefillos. Moments later, the good news arrived, and Shabbos was ushered in by the people of Frankfurt. So the baby was born right before Shabbos. On the 7th of Tishrei, 5523, the distinguished Sofer family, Reb Shmuel, a grandson of the revered Reb Shmuel Shatin, and his wife Reizel, the daughter of the saint Reb Elchanan, had been blessed with a son, a new link in the glorious chain. The child was named Moshe for his paternal grandfather. Rabbi Abishal, beloved Rav of Frankfurt, passed away just 6 years later, but he did live long enough to see the early stages of the boy's growth. I heard another, well, let's keep reading and I'll tell you something else. He will yet stand tall, a beacon of light to the entire generation. The Rav would tell Rabbi Shmuel Moshe, so Moshe so for his father. On Simchas Torah, one year, Rabbi Abishal embraced the boy and danced with him. After the dance was complete, the Rav remarked that he had held a Sefer Torah in his arms. As community others would reflect in later years, it wasn't just the Frankfurt Kehillah that had waited for the child to be born. All of creation had been waiting for that moment. Okay, so that's how they write in article biographies. So maybe take that with a grain of salt. But the truth is, the way that the story actually goes that I heard from others is that when he was born, the Rav of the community, Rabbi Abishal, he actually named him right there before anyone had a chance to. He said his name is going to be Moshe. Why did he decide his name would be Moshe? He said because he's going to be like one of the great leaders of Klal Yisrael. We of course all know Moshe Rabbeinu, and as such he called him Moshe because he knew that somehow, how he knew it's unclear, but he knew that he was going to be destined for greatness. So he named him Moshe right then and there. But anyway, so you see from the very beginning of the Chasam Sofer's life that clearly he was destined for greatness. Again, it's always hard to tell whenever you have these biographies, in particular with someone like the Chasam Sofer, because he was living a few hundred years ago, right? It wasn't like a more contemporary Rabbanim where we can say we have at least living people who are witness to who he was in some of these stories. So sometimes you have to take these stories with a grain of salt. But nonetheless, I did see this story and heard this story in so many places that you assume that there probably is at least a significant amount of truth to it. And it just shows you the greatness of who he was and the kind of family that he was born into, and the expectations for his greatness were clear at a very young age. In 1768, at age 6, the Chasam Sofer was learning with his Rebbe. This is another one of the very famous stories they tell about him. And the way the story goes is that his teacher was teaching him a certain pasuk, and that the pasuk didn't actually make any sense. The Chasam Sofer heard the Rebbe's Yiddish translation of the Hebrew pasuk, and the 6-year-old boy said that doesn't make sense because, again, I don't want to go too deep into it now, but he was describing creation, and the translation of the pasuk seemed off to him. So the Chasam Sofer at the age of 6 questioned what the Rebbe was saying. The Rebbe didn't like the fact that the 6-year-old boy was questioning, so he smacked him across the face. Again, in the year 2020, that sounds kind of crazy, but those of us who may be a little bit older know that that wasn't so crazy, certainly a few hundred years ago, to slap a kid in the face if he said something disrespectful. The response, however, was something kind of wild. His father saw that the boy was so dejected, he saw that his son Moshe was so dejected by the Rebbe because he slapped him across the face, that the father decided to speak to another one of the Rebbeim in the community, Rav Nosson Adler. Rav Nosson Adler would be one of the two main Rabbanim that the Chasam Sofer would refer to as his Rebbe throughout his lifetime. And Rav Nosson Adler actually told the Chasam Sofer, his father, that he had to take him away from this Rebbe. This Rebbe should not be teaching him because he clearly doesn't know how to teach, at least properly, to the Chasam Sofer, to this little boy Moshe. As a result, the Rebbe, Rav Nosson Adler, said to the father, to the Chasam Sofer's father, you have to teach him Torah. You can't rely on anyone else to teach him. You have to teach him yourself. So the way the story goes is that the Chasam Sofer's father quit his job, and his full-time occupation was trying to take care of his boy Moshe to help him learn Torah, to teach him Torah. At age 10, in the year 1772, it's actually kind of I don't know if ironic is the right word, but it's interesting. A similar occurrence seems to have happened between the Chasam Sofer and his father himself, that the father got upset at his son. And let's see what happens. Source number 2 on page 3. So the custom was... Source number 2. The custom was that each Shabbos, one of Rav Nosson's Tamidim would offer a public discourse, a shir, attended by local scholars and dignitaries. So at this point, the Chasam Sofer was learning under Rav Nosson Adler. So when it was 10 years... When it was 10-year-old Moshe's turn, a large crowd assembled, eager to hear from the young prodigy. During the drasha, the child quoted a complex question posed by his great-grandfather, the Marsha Shach. The audience discussed the incisive question, and the child held up his hand. Right? Everyone's like, you know, saying, oh my gosh, what a great question, whatever. The 10-year-old boy said, oh, everyone hold on for one moment. He says, perhaps the question isn't really difficult, and with respect to my honored ancestor, it might well be based on an error. So you have a 10-year-old boy here questioning what one of the greatest gadolim of the, in particular one of his ancestors from a few generations before, had said. When Rav Shmuel, that's the Chasam Sofer's father again, heard this, he reached out and slapped his son, upset at the slight of his revered grandfather. Right. So at first glance, you hear something like that. It doesn't sound so out of line. You hear a 10-year-old boy speaking disrespectfully about his ancestors, his great-grandfather, so it makes sense he slapped him across the face. Nonetheless, look at what happened. There was a moment of complete silence, and the child, overcome with humiliation, stopped the shear. Later on, Rav Nosson asked his Talmidim to review the shir and tell him what the young boy had said. He was informed about the distressful incident. Rav Nosson called his beloved Talmid to him and issued a painful ruling. Listen to this. "You are not to speak with your father anymore," said Rav Adler. The Rebbe said, worried Rav Shmuel, as Rav Shmuel himself had once been years earlier, that a similar experience would suppress the child's insatiable desire to learn and produce Chiddushei Torah. It was clear that Rav Shmuel had acted only out of concern that his child learned to speak with respect and reverence about those who came before him, but still, the child had a destiny, and the Rebbe was determined to remove any impediment from his path, right? So it's interesting to see how Rav Adler and certainly Rav Abishal in the previous source, how they were so confident that this boy would become such a gadol that they were able to determine how to act based on their expectations of him. So they said, you can't talk to your father anymore. The soldier, Moshe Sofer, went home and in the presence of his father repeated his Rebbe's ruling to his mother. Rav Shmuel was deeply hurt, but he understood Rav Nosson's directive and accepted it as well. From then on, Moshe would continue to serve his father and show him respect, but they would not exchange words. Sorry, that was like part of the... It was right there. Okay, so anyways, what we have from here is an incredible fact of the Chassam Sofer's life, that from this moment on, that his father would not live for too many more years after this, but he never spoke to his father ever again because of what Rav Adler said. And again, at least as far as I've been able to gather, and the reason seems to be because, as Rebbe said, you can't talk to your father because your father himself seems to not understand the greatness of Torah that you are destined to become. Okay, so in the year 1776, by the age of 14, he went to learn in one yeshiva by Rav Michel Shire in Mayence in Germany. By the age of 15, he returned to Frankfurt to continue learning. The reason why he had gone for just a little bit was because it was so difficult with his family. His father was an incredible person in his own right, and therefore both he and his son respected the psak or Rav Adler not to talk to each other. So it was a little awkward in the home, right, that he couldn't talk to his father. Seemingly not to talk at all. That's how the basic understanding is. The way that some of the biographies write it is that he still continues to have proper kibbutz. He still treated his father respectfully, but they just would not have conversations with one another. So maybe they would signal, I don't know exactly what they did, but that's how the story goes. So he had to leave for a short period of time because it was very difficult to be in the house, because how do you not talk to your father? So he left, but then again, he returned by the age of 15 once more. By the age of 17, Rav Shmuel Sofer, the Chassam Sofer's father, had passed away, so it was only about 7 years that he had to live with this decree. I don't know, it could be that by the end of his life, maybe they did speak, I'm not sure, but that's how the story goes. Okay. A few years later, the Chassam Sofer's Rebbe, Rav Nosson Adler, he left to become a Rav somewhere else. Now, this was very difficult for the Chassam Sofer because he lost his father, and now his main Rebbe, Rav Nosson Adler, was going to leave town as well. As such, the Chassam Sofer decides to follow his Rebbe. Just before we get there, I just want to say parenthetically a quick point. So, like I said, Rav Nosson Adler is one of the main Rebbeim of the Chassam Sofer in his lifetime. The other one is another Rav from Frankfurt, who's known as the Hafla, Rabbi Pinchas Halevi Horowitz. He was the other Rebbe that the Chassam Sofer had learned from a great deal throughout his lifetime. Okay, so by the age of 23, the Chassam Sofer, like I mentioned, had a run after his Rebbe, so he was with his Rebbe for a number of years. But by the age of 23, the Chassam Sofer and his Rebbe, Rav Nosson Adler, decided that they were both going to return to Frankfurt together. As they were going back to Frankfurt, Rav Nosson turned to his Talmud, to the Chassam Sofer, and he says, "You can't come back to Frankfurt with me. You have to go to the town of Prusnitz." Now, the only reason why you have a map in source number 3 is because I just thought it was interesting to see how far Frankfurt is from Prusnitz. Again, I assume that they're the same cities to this day for the most part. So if you look at source number 3 in the map, so Frankfurt's all the way at the bottom by the red dot, and Prusnitz is all the way on top. So it seems pretty far. It's an 8-hour and 11-minute drive, according to Google Maps. So that's how far they were from each other. And he said, no, you have to go to Prusnitz. The Chassam Sofer was understandably reluctant to go to Prusnitz to be the Rav in the community or to be learning there, to do whatever, because of the fact that, if you remember from some of the other shirim that we've offered in the past, in particular, we spoke about it, I think, last Tisha B'Av, but Shabtai Tzvi, the culture had been so affected by Shabtai Tzvi, the false Messiah that had risen not many years before this, and in particular in Prusnitz, there were a lot of Sabbateans, as they call them, a lot of people who were followers of Shabtai Tzvi, and so the Chassam Sofer was understandably very nervous service to go there, but nonetheless, his Rebbe said you have to go to the town of Prajna, so that's exactly where he went. When he first got there to the town of Prajna, his Rebbe didn't give him specific instructions about what he wanted him to do, so he said that he didn't say anything, so he went and sat and learned for a little bit. It became pretty clear after some time that he was a genuine budding Torah scholar and Talmud Chacham, so he began to build a bit of a group around him. At first he was giving shiurim just to boys, and after some time he was giving shiurim, I think all day, they say, to both boys and grown men. He was giving shiurim to everyone. People had realized the greatness that he was destined to become, again, even though he was a stranger in this land, essentially. He was approached at this point shiduchim, right? People saw that he was a great young Torah scholar, seemed like a great guy, so they said, oh, fine, so let's find him a shidduch. Someone even approached him and said, I have a shidduch for you, and it'll be great. You'll marry the girl, her father will support you, and you'll become the Rav of the town. What more can anyone want? The Chassam Sofer, early in his life, at this point, he totally refused the idea that he would ever have to become a Rav. He did not want to become a Rav at all. He just wanted to be able to sit and learn. And okay, he would take on a trade so he could make a little money, but he had no interest in becoming the leader of an entire congregation, or certainly not the leader of an entire town or a city, and certainly he did not want to be the luminary of all the Jewish people of his generation. But the Machzis HaShekel, one of the Rebbeim of the time of Shmuel Kellen, who was sort of involved in this potential shidduch prospect for him to maybe marry this girl where he'd have a good deal going, where he'd be supported by his father-in-law to be the rabbi of the community. So he came over to the Chassam Sofer, even though the Chassam Sofer said no to the shidduch, says, I don't want to be involved in this. So this rabbi came over to him and said, I want you to know that there are some people who are able to avoid going to Rabbanus in their lifetime, but you, it's so clear that you're destined for greatness. Again, someone else who saw his greatness, so he said, you're not going to be able to avoid the Rabbanus forever. At some point, Hashem's basically going to put you in a situation where you're going to have to accept the Rabbanus in a certain town. By the age of 24, in the year 1786, Rav Moshe Sofer married a woman who would be his wife for the next 26 years, or something like that. Her name was Sarah Yurowitz. She was an interesting choice for a young budding Torah scholar, certainly in those times, because she was A, married before, she was widowed, and she was also older than the Chassam Sofer. So that was something that was not done so much in those days, but nonetheless, he met her and it seemed like a good shidduch. He was very excited to introduce her to his family and then to marry her. He went back home. He hadn't been home in a number of years. He went back home to his mother and to his Rebbe. They all said, don't marry her. So she should not be marrying this woman. He was very sad because he's like, no, I'm all ready to be married with her. He goes back. He is so concerned, he doesn't know what to do, because certainly to go against his mother and his Rebbe, that's like, you know, a two-for-one deal, sounds terrible to him. So what ends up happening is that he writes a letter to his Rebbe once he's already back, he's already back in Prajnitz, and he says, please, Rebbe, whatever you tell me, I'll do, so let me know, should I marry the girl or not? He asks for a final decision from him. The Rebbe does not answer him. And so Chassam Sofer says to himself, since I have not heard from my Rebbe, I'll take it as a sign from Shemayim, from heaven, that I'm supposed to marry this girl. He marries the girl, and you think that they live happily ever after. The truth is they do live happily ever after. However, a few weeks later, he gets a letter from his Rebbe saying, don't marry the girl. Then takes the fact that he received the letter from his Rebbe after the fact to be a sign from heaven that it was clear that he was supposed to marry this woman. Him and his wife, Sarah, never end up having children together. And so we'll see what happens in just a little bit in their lifetime. But so they never have children together. In 1793, by the age of 31, the Chassam Sofer moved with his wife to a place called Dresnitz to become a Rav of the town. I just forgot to mention, so I'll go back for one moment. While he was in Prajnitz with his wife, with his new wife, so the deal was that his brother-in-law, I believe, was supposed to be supporting him, and he supported him for a number of years, and it was great. The Chassam Sofer could sit and learn, and he had this beautiful new wife. However, at some point, his brother-in-law's funds ran out, and he wasn't able to support them anymore, and that's basically the point where the Chassam Sofer says, okay, I guess I have to go find a job. So that's what he did. He found a job, and he moved to Dresnitz to become the Rav of the town, again at the age of 31 in the year 1793. He was the Rav in this town for 5 years. The Chassam Sofer would often talk about his time as the Rebbe in this town for many years, so I think for the rest of his life even, because of the fact that it was such a relaxing time. It wasn't, there weren't too many things that were asked of him, and he did, he was able to learn, he was able to write, he was a prolific writer, as we'll see later on in the shiur, but he was able to basically enjoy himself and also have a hashpa, have an influence on other people, and it was really a special time in his life. By the year 1797, at the age of 35, he becomes the Rav of Mattersdorf. When he was in Mattersdorf, he ends up staying there as the Rav for 9 years. Truth be told, he actually tried to leave before those 9 years, but what happened was that at one point the town was ravaged by a terrible fire, and he, as the Rav of the town, felt like it wasn't right for him to leave when everything was in such destruction. So he stays there again. He ends up staying there for a total of 9 years in total to help rebuild the town. Once the town was totally rebuilt and basically back on his feet, that's when he decided, okay, it's time for me to leave. By the age of 44, in the year 1806, the Chassam Sofer became the Rav of Pressburg. Now this is what we call the rest of history. The Chassam Sofer would stay in Pressburg for the rest of his life. He would live there for the next 33 years until he passed away. The Chassam Sofer... at the age of 45, in the year 1807, that's when he would found the famous Pressburg Yeshiva. So this became Yeshiva that would produce many, many important Talmidim and many important Gedolei Yisrael. In particular, probably the most well-known Talmud of the Chassam Sofer was the Maharam Shik, Rabbi Moshe Shik. He was learning in his yeshiva, and he became a Talmud Mofak of the Chassam Sofer. The one thing that they say about the Chassam Sofer, that the Chassam Sofer said about himself, again, in absolute humility, but in just reality, is that he never missed a shir in his life. Every single day of the year, he would always say shir, except for Tisha B'Av. But other than that, for 33 years, I guess, maybe even before that, he said shir 364 days a year, except for that one day on Tisha B'Av. In the year 1809, by the age of 47, there were a lot of battles going on in the area, particularly for anyone who knows a little bit of European history. So Napoleon was around at this time, and Napoleon was having many battles in order to expand his territories, and Pressburg sort of fell in the middle of all this. As a result, the Chassam Sofer actually did leave Pressburg for about a month and a half, I think 42 days is the exact number. He left Pressburg because it was dangerous there, and he figured it was not safe for him to be there, so he left for a period of time. However, he returned again, once again, to a town that needed to be rebuilt, and that was something that he always took on with stride, as we saw. Previously, he always was sort of like the Renaissance rabbi, if you will. Someone who was always willing to get his hands dirty to do whatever his kehillah needed. We'll see in a few more things that he did throughout his lifetime. But he didn't just teach Torah, he didn't just take achrayos for the spirituality of the congregation, but also even the physical stuff. He wanted to make sure everyone was comfortable, everyone was taken care of, especially if the town was in dire need. If it was destroyed through battles, that certainly was going to be something that would fall in his wheelhouse of skill, something that he wanted to do to help the congregation rebuild. Once things started to get back to some semblance of normality, the town was, I think, 2 or 3 years later, everything was getting back to normal. In the year 1812, when the Chassam Sofer was 50 years old, his wife Sarah passed away. Shortly after she passed away, however, he then remarried again. He remarried very famously. This is this marriage probably is more famous because of two reasons. One, because he ended up having 11 children with this woman, and his children are known, obviously, through this marriage. And the second reason is that his wife that he married was the daughter of Rabbi Akiva Eger. Rabbi Akiva Eger was one of the greatest gedolim of the time as well. Take a look at source number 4. We're not going to read the whole thing, but we'll read parts of it. So source number 4 on page 4. Rabbi Akiva Eger was one of the greatest scholars of his time, who had a great influence on Jewish life. He was born Eisenstadt, Hungary, in the year 5521, nearly 200 years ago. The city of his birth was a seat of learning for centuries, and his family was a family of scholars and rabbis. Skip down to the second to last paragraph. Rabbi Akiva Eger's greatness of heart and selfless devotion to his community can be seen from the following event. In the year 1831, a terrible cholera epidemic swept Central and Eastern Europe. Posen was among the cities stricken with this fatal sickness, and entire sections of the city were quarantined and forbidden to be entered. Now you know why I wanted to read this paragraph. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Akiva Eger disregarded the danger and went into the stricken sections of the city to care for the sick. King Frederick III of Prussia heard of this heroism of the famous rabbi and honored him with a special medal. But again, this is one of the very, very many stories of the greatness of Rabbi Akiva Eger. Not only was he an absolute Torah luminary, and so on, to this day he was still quoted in the Beis Medrash regularly for his Torah Chidushim and his Torah insight, but he was just a very special individual as well. Yeah.
So he was the same, his father-in-law, he was the same.
Yes. When the Chassam Sofer married the daughter of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, so they were approximately the same age. They were actually known to be pretty good friends. We'll see just how cute their friendship was in a second. But the daughter was 25. So yeah, it's a little weird, but I mean, I don't know, not so much. Especially for those times. I don't know, so 25-year age difference for those times, I don't know, it just doesn't shock me so much. I don't know, personally. Okay.
It happens. My grandfather was 22 years older than my grandma.
Oh, sorry, we have proof right here. Sorry. Sorry.
Love.
Say it.
No, I just said my grandfather was 22 years older than my grandmother.
Okay,
there you have it. He was with 10 children, and she was 22 years old when the rabbis forced her to marry him. Well, not forced her, but talked her into it, because she was from a poor family, and he was a wealthy guy. So to speak.
Wow, and that wasn't in the 1700s. That was more recently.
This what?
That was not in the 1700s. That was more recently.
No, it's somewhere around 1800.
Okay, so take a look at source number. Where am I? Source number five. To get a sense of the cute relationship that Rabbi Akiva Eiger and the Chassam Sofer had. On page five, it writes as follows: a local businessman worked quickly, approaching the Rav with an offer of a fabulous dowry if the Rav would marry his only daughter, a young woman of great character and reputation. This was when the Chassam Sofer was still single. He would support the Rav's every endeavor, every initiative to build Torah, but as the Chassam Sofer considered his options, a letter arrived from the Rav of Friedland, the revered Rabbi Akiva Eiger. The Gaon of Friedland had recently lost his son-in-law, Rav Avraham Moshe, Rav of Fila, and he was seeking a match for his daughter, the young widow. He thought that the Pressburger Rav, with as many contacts in the world of Rabbanus, might have a suggestion. The Chassam Sofer shared the letter with his confidant and close Talmud, Rav Daniel Prajnitz, head of the Pressburg Beis Din. A wise Talmud, Rav Daniel, understood his Rebbe's unexpressed intention, and he quickly dispatched a letter to Rabbi Akiva Eiger, suggesting a match between the Chassam Sofer and Rabbi Akiva Eger's daughter. During this period, Rav Bunim Eger, Rav of Mattersdorf, and brother of Rabbi Akiva Eger, had the very same idea. He too wrote a letter to the Chassam Sofer suggesting the match. He wrote about his widowed niece, describing her lineage, her character, her love for Torah, and those that learn it. He made it clear that his glowing recommendation was completely rooted in truth, because even though I'm partial to my brother, whom I love, Hashem is the God of truth, and I cherish that ideal with all my heart and soul. The Chassam Sofer was intrigued. In a letter, he had referred to Rabbi Akiva Eiger as a friend who was closer than a brother, and now he saw no need to ask others for information. He turned directly to his friend, Rabbi Akiva Eiger himself, asking his opinion of the match. Rabbi Akiva Eiger wrote back, lavishing his daughter with praise, but concluding with a disclaimer. There was one glaring imperfection. If the Chassam Sofer wanted to marry the daughter of a Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Akiva Eiger wrote, that then the girl was deficient in that area. Right? Rabbi Akiva Eiger was her father. The Chassam Sofer replied, he appreciated Rabbi Akiva Eiger's recommendations and was willing to take responsibility regarding the Bas Talmud Chacham issue, but he felt compelled to issue a warning of his own. Then there is a mandate to give one's daughter to a scholar, he wrote, and Rabbi Akiva Eiger was considering marrying his daughter off to an Alma Aretz. Right, so it's a very cute story how they both basically were so humble, but ultimately he ended up marrying Rabbi Akiva Eiger's daughter, and again, they had 10 children with one another. Of the children that they had, so all of them were sort of famous in their own right. I think they had 4 sons and 7 daughters. One of the sons unfortunately passed away at a very young age, but his 3 sons became very big rabbanim. In particular, the one whom some of you might have actually heard of is the son, Rabbi Avraham Shmuel Binyamin Sofer. He was known as the Ksav Sofer, right? So he has his own svarim in his own right. So he was his oldest son, and he, again, so he was a big rav. Take a look at source number 6, just a very quick bio of him. Oldest son of the Chassam Sofer and Sorel, daughter of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. He was known as the Ksav Sofer after the Chassam Sofer's death in 1839. The Ksav Sofer succeeded him as rabbi and as head of the important yeshiva in Pressburg at the unusually young age of 24. Following in the footsteps of his illustrious father, the Ksav Sofer was a distinguished scholar as well as strong and influential communal leader. Okay, so he was a very big Talmud Chacham as well. The Chassam Sofer, among all the accomplishments in his life, is probably most well known for the fact that he became one of the biggest gedolei poskim in Jewish history, certainly in recent history. By the end of his life, the way it's recorded is that he had answered over 1,300 tshuvos, shaylos, tshuvos, halachic questions in terms of like penning them to paper and giving answers to them, I believe. Take a look at source number 7, which talks about his greatness and his ability to give halachic psak. The Chassam Sofer would review the incoming mail each day and read through the shilos, the many halachic queries that came from across the country and beyond. He would finish reading the shila, and without hesitation, he would lift his pen and start writing the tshuvos. The answers seemed to flow out of his pen, a sea of ink covering pages with words of clarity and direction. Looking on, the Chassam Sofer's son, Rav Shimon, wondered how his father could offer answers so quickly, ruling on serious issues without deliberating at all. He asked his father about it, and the Chassam Sofer admitted that in truth, such matters require careful forethought. But you should know, my son, understand before we read this, that the Chassam Sofer was an absolute anav. He was totally humble, but he still said the following. He was self-aware. But you should know, my son, that in each generation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu selects a person to serve as posek, to enlighten others in the ways of halacha. The fact that so many people send me questions would indicate that I am that person. Baruch Hashem, I feel like I've learned enough to be able to answer, and my intention is only to increase the honor of heaven. Therefore, I feel confident that I will merit divine assistance and rulings will be accurate. Again, he was an incredibly humble individual, but he understood who he was and where he was at. So he was certainly the most significant posek of his generation, it would seem. Another thing that his children would say about him is that just like this, I believe that every time he would receive some sort of shayla, he would always respond that very day. He would almost never let it go for more than another day, if ever. The Chassam Sofer, other than just being an incredible posek and gadol, he was known for sharing stories about the Gedolim at his Shabbos table. Something that he liked to do and something that he valued so much was that, other than just learning the black and white text of the halacha, of the Torah, you also have to be able to learn from the Maaseh Tzaddikim, from the stories of the righteous people. One story in particular, and I believe this was supposedly a regular occurrence that happened at his table, at a Shabbos table. He was sitting at a Shabbos table, and I guess it depends on the summer or the winter, depending on how impressed you want to be by the following, but he was telling stories about his Rebbeim, and all of a sudden the time for Mincha came, so they all went to Davin Mincha together. He was totally so immersed in the stories, he didn't realize it was Man Mincha, but he went to go Daven Mincha. He came back after Mincha to his table, and he continued exactly where he left off with the stories. That was what the Chassam Sofer was all about, not just learning the black and white text of the Torah, but learning from the stories of our great rabbis, and he would always love to tell these stories at his Shabbos table. In the year 1819, by the age of 57, the Chassam Sofer would begin what would be known as the most famous battle of his lifetime, and that is dealing with the reform movement that was budding at this time. We spent a great deal of time discussing the reform movement when we spoke about Rav Shamson Rafael Hirsch earlier this year, and basically, so many things that happened in Rav Shamson Rafael Hirsch's life were sort of obviously they happened after because he lived afterwards, but the Chassam Sofer was sort of the foundation of the general response that Orthodox Jewry, mainstream Orthodox Jewry, would take to the Reform Movement from that day and truthfully even to this very day. Truth be told, we're not as kharif as he was back in his day, because the Reform Movement had a lot more strength in his time, but nonetheless, the Chassam Sofer was the foundation of all responses to the Reform Movement starting from then until now. Take a look at source number 8. So one of the famous comments, one of the famous lines that come out of the Chassam Sofer was this comment of Chadash Aser Min HaTorah. Very famous line that the Chassam Sofer used to talk about the Reform Movement. It says, what it literally means is that anything new is prohibited. We don't allow new things in Judaism. It's true, we have the back and forth of the living Torah, living Halacha, and so Torah is able to deal with every question, even questions that didn't come up 2,000 years ago, but that we don't allow new things in Judaism. It all has to be somehow rooted in the text. The Chassam Sofer used that to refer to the Reform Movement, who they were all making new things and making new decrees right and left. And the reason why it was such a cute line is because there's something called Chadash. A person cannot have the new grains, and that's called Chadash. So he said, sort of like a cute pun, that Chadash is also that not just the Chadash, not just the produce, but also the Chadash, meaning anything new, any new decree that's made, we don't accept that as well. So again, source number 8, he says, take a look. Let's not read this right now. You'll take a look at the first line of the second paragraph, though. Sofer's, the Chassam Sofer's reputation for stringency was well earned in light of his best known responsa, which were aimed at religious reformers. So again, you take a look at this source. It talks all about his relationship with the Reform Jews. In particular, the Chassam Sofer also built up another reputation, not just being against the Reform movement, but also he was known for his incredible stringencies. Some historians, together, for better or for worse, for right or for wrong, some historians point to the Chassam Sofer as being one of the most machmir rabbeim, one of the most stringent rabbeim in relative recent history, and he sort of was the movement, as some people would say. Again, I'm not a big proponent of saying this, or certainly saying this publicly, but again, this is for the purposes of the class and learning a little bit about the Chassam Sofer, and to understand the historical context. Some people, I think, say that the Chassam Sofer was like the beginning of like the Orthodox movement towards the right. Right, so it's a little bit of a stretch, maybe, but people say that why has Orthodox Judaism become ever increasingly stringent in terms of our perspective of halacha? Certainly, then you would assume that it was 500 years ago, perhaps. So people say it's because the Chassam Sofer and his response to the Reform movement was such that he was always doubling down on the stringencies to make it seem like we don't want to be anything like the Reform movement. Source number 9 is a tshuva that one of the many tshuvas that the Chassam Sofer wrote. In particular, this tshuva is about where to put the bima in shul. We're not going to do it inside as well, but it was about where to put the bima in shul. We know that our bima usually sits in the center of the shul, and there was a big push to maybe put the bima in the front of the shul. Why do they want to put the bima in the front of the shul? Well, because that's what the churches were doing. Everyone else was doing that. It's nice to have the bima right up in front. It's more like majestic, maybe. So many reasons were given to make it look nicer, to put it in the front. Chassam Sofer said, no, we don't do that. Chadash Aser Min HaTorah, we have to keep the beam exactly where it has been for the past thousands of years, so he didn't move it at all. Again, he was very anti any change that smelled like a move towards reform or any other religion, God forbid. The Chassam Sofer, as we said earlier, was all about doing everything as much as he could for his community. Take a look at source number 10. He writes, the source writes as follows: when fire had ripped through Matersurf late in the winter of 5562, right, not where we're currently at in his life, but years before, the Chassam Sofer slated to leave for Neustadt. He made a decision that would define his leadership. He noticed the people of Neustadt, he notified the people of Neustadt that he couldn't come. Matersurf needed him, and if a few days earlier he had felt he could leave, everything had just changed. The Mattersdorf, from which he had already bid farewell, became his kehila once more as he oversaw the rebuilding process. He raised funds and ensured that there was an ample supply of food and clothing, as well as temporary housing for displaced families. He visited local non-Jewish nobles and inspired them to donate building supplies, and he worked with construction workers to supervise the reconstruction of the Jewish Mattersdorf. Again, I apologize, my voice is getting ever increasingly weaker, so you can feel free to read the rest on your own. But basically, this whole source is about how he was an incredible rabbi. Again, not just focused on the spirituality, but way beyond that. He wanted to make sure that everyone in the community was happy and healthy and well cared for. And as such, this source really proves that very clearly and nicely. His legacy is one that will be remembered for many things, but take a look at source number 11. There was a line on page, I think, 12. There was a line in the Chassam Sofer's Tzava, the will he penned, an expression of his deepest hopes. It was the sum total of his life's work, the very last line of the final request he made of his Creator. May it be your will, giver of the Torah, may your name be blessed, that the wellspring not run dry, and the tree not be uprooted. Shelo yivash hamayan velo yikatsetz ha'ilam. The Chassam Sofer had dug new wells, discovering a flow of living waters. Into a world still bruised by the blow of the Shabbosai Tzvi, he brought healing. Into an era when Haskalah and Reform seemed poised to go to the right side now, capture the masses, he brought back confidence and courage. His yeshiva would completely redraw the landscape, filling the darkness with the song of Torah. Pressburger Talmidim would become the Rabbanim and respected Baal Batim and Kehilas across the country, and many of them would open their own yeshivas, right? So in other words, what this is saying over here is that the legacy of the Chassam Sofer was such that it's almost as if that he was the beginning of modern history, right? Modern Jewish history. There was so, the Jewish history at this point, we've spoken about in the past, God willing, we'll have many opportunities to speak about more in the future, but this time in Jewish history was so significant because of the fact that so many of the Jewish communities were totally left in ruin after the whole Shabbatai Tzvi movements. And what the Chassam Sofer did was brick by brick, he rebuilt the whole community, not just from the Torah perspective, but also from the physical perspective as well. His attitude and approach would become the accepted path for generations of Rabbanim. 100 years after his passing, loyal adherents of the Chassam Sofer's way were still waging his war and triumphing just as he did. The world of Austro-Hungarian Yiddishkeit remained vibrant and strong, a bulwark against grand size of Haskala and assimilation, credits the great general from Pressburg. And leading the charge for traditional authentic Yiddishkeit were the Chasam Sofer's children and grandchildren in Pressburg and across Poland and Galicia, they carried forth the torch he ignited. And until today, they lead and inspire and fortify Jewish hearts, reminding a nation weary and exhausted by the travails of the journey of who she is and where she's going. And every time a descendant of the Chasam Sofer or his Talmidim stands tall, one hears the whisper of long ago when the great Rav of Pressburg raised his eyes to heaven and asked in his final will, Shel Yivash HaMayan Veli Katzei Tzeilan, may the wellspring not run dry, and may the tree not be uprooted. The Chasam Sofer was all about reinvigorating and rejuvenating the Jewish world and the Torah world, and he accomplished that in an incredible way, and he was able to leave this lasting legacy, which again, today, our modern Orthodox Judaism, in so many ways, is based off of the legacy of what the Chasam Sofer left for us and left for his Talmidim and every single one of us in so many ways. The Chasam Sofer, as we said earlier, was a prolific writer. Not only did he write so many Chidushi Torah, he wrote, obviously he wrote so many Shilas and Shuvos, and I believe he wrote a Perish on Shas as well. He wrote a Perish on Chumash. But not just that, he would write poetry, he had a diary, I think you could even buy it, I think they sell a version of a diary that he wrote of all the things happening in Pressburg during the Napoleonic era, so he has a diary as well, to get an even further understanding of the lasting legacy that he has, so the Chasam Sofer's yeshiva that he started in Pressburg, again 220 years ago or so, so to this day in Israel, there is a new Pressburg yeshiva that it was founded by one of his great-great-great-grandsons, and to this day it's still led, I think, by one of his descendants, one of his great-great-great-grandsons. I think the Rav is Rav Sofer, who is the Rosh Yeshiva of that yeshiva. The Chasam Sofer ends up dying on October 3rd, 1839, at the age of 77, the 25th of Tishrei, in the year 5600. The lasting legacy that he left will not be forgotten. We'll speak about that in just a moment, but I want to tell you one quick thing about the Chasam Sofer's Kever. It would seem futile if we didn't actually talk a little bit about the incredible story about the grave of the Chasam Sofer. The grave of the Chasam Sofer, you go to any of the Kivrei Tzadikim, so you'll always see some big matseva that says how incredible they were and how amazing they were, what they did for the Jewish people. You go to the Chasam Sofer's Kever, take a look at source number 13, you do not see any tombstones at all, you just see a bunch of glass things sticking out of the ground. And then if you look on page 14, you go underneath those glass things, and there are all the graves. So for some reason, you have all these glass things sticking on top, but the graves are underground. So what in the world is the story? So take a look at the paragraph on page 14, underneath the picture. Dr. Henry Abramson is the one who wrote this article. For those of you who don't know, Dr. Henry Abramson is an incredible historian in the Jewish community. I believe he works at Sorrow College, and he's just an absolute expert in so many of these areas. So this article is about the time when he visited this kever, and he tells the whole story about what happened. Unexpected and unexplained, a phalanx of glass obelisks emerged silently from the earth mound, punctuating the atmosphere above what appears to be an anonymous tell. Some are transparent, others pebbled and translucent, but all glow with a faint green hue. Unyielding, they stand in rigid formation on the angled surface of the earth. These mute sentinels bear witness to the earthly remains and a heavenly designation of 23 holy Jews of Bratislava, Slovakia, as well as the saintly scholar Moshe Schreiber, known in the generations of his followers as the seal of the scribe, the Chasam Sofer. Skip the next paragraph. A heavy black triangle juts out alongside the glass sentinels. I apologize, I don't have a picture of that, but basically there's like a giant black wall that's behind or in front of all these glass things. A heavy black triangle juts out alongside the glass sentinels, running at an oblique angle to the road. Inside, a solemn slot like narrow entrance allows reluctant access to the underground mausoleum where the Chasam Sofer and 22 other holy Jews lie intact and undisturbed since the Second World War. The story of their survival and death is as remarkable as the monument built to commemorate them. A pre-war photograph documents the size of the old Jewish cemetery of the city formerly known as Pressburg. Since the 17th century, thousands of Jews lay buried on the bank of the Danube there, their tombstones glowing with ethereal light as darkness gave way to dawn every morning. So in other words, this was part of a much larger Jewish cemetery. A deeper darkness descended on the community in 1943 when local pro-German fascists confiscated the cemetery with plans to pave it over for new tram lines. in what would be one of their last acts as a community. The Jews of Bratislava begged for permission to exhume the remains of their ancestors for reburial in the newer Jewish cemetery. For reasons which are unclear, the fascists granted this request and even grudgingly allowed for the protection in situ of the Chatam Sofer's grave and those that immediately surrounded it. Money undoubtedly played a role in this begrudging mercy, probably accelerated by a rumor that a terrible curse would befall anyone who disturbed these holy bones. A massive concrete sarcophagus was constructed around the protected tombs, sealing them in below the tramlines that eventually carried Bratislava's commuters to work every day. With the fall of communism, a consortium of philanthropists, Jewish communal leaders, and Slovak politicians arranged for the construction of the modern mausoleum designed by the award-winning Slovak architect The non-Jewish Kvasnika, born in 1958, had previously only worked on one small Jewish project, a kosher kitchen for the emerging Bratislava community, led by Chief Rabbi Baruch Myers, a Chabad Shliach originally from New Jersey. With Chief Rabbi Baruch Myers and Prague historian David Krauss, researching the complex considerations necessitated by Jewish law, Kvasnika designed a memorial befitting the stature of the Chasam Sofer. Dignified and otherworldly, Kvasnika's artistic genius literally invites the pilgrim to descend, literally, into the grave of Rabbi Sofer, while at the same time the visitor perceives the ongoing influence of this immortal spiritual giant. Kvasnika's art demonstrates how not even the Nazis could extinguish the flame of his Torah. Architect Martin Kvasnika, drawing of the entrance to the Chasam Sofer memorial, there's a picture that I left out. The disciple who first encounters the site may be puzzled by the mute aqua obelisk standing above ground, but that first sensation is dissipated by the unease one feels walking into the black stone entryway. Narrow and confining, open to the sky like a traditional Ohel grave, the floor slopes down to a right angle entry to the left. A last warning to the visitor is posted there in Hebrew, English, German, and Slovak: respect this holy place. Only one word separates the Hebrew text from the translations, the word readers of Hebrew thus receive a nuanced message. Lufanecha. A holy place lies before you. The site has sanctity for all visitors, but for Jews, this is personal. This is the grave of our revered teacher, a link in the chain of transmission of Torah from Sinai to the present day, a chain that reaches to our own generation. Okay, so you can keep reading if you want, but basically the whole idea is that the whole cemetery was wiped out, but for whatever reason, the Nazis allowed them to keep this part, and again, so at one point it was totally paved over, but they still knew where the location was. They decided to build this new modern-day mausoleum in relative recent years to, again, have a lasting legacy of who the Chasam Sofer was. And there is something beautiful also. I'm not sure if Dr. Abramson actually said this or if I just thought about it, but either way, it's a nice idea that what you see from here, I guess he did say it essentially in the article, that what's so beautiful is that the glass that's sort of above the ground, that's sort of just into the ground, it shows how there's this lasting legacy of the Chasam Sofer, because the glass goes underground and it sort of shoots up above ground, showing how the Chasam Sofer, even though he's no longer in this world, his legacy is still living on in many ways above ground. Take a look at source number 12, and with this we will end. So it's one idea that's from the Chasam Sofer on this upcoming week's Parsha and Kitisa. So the Pasuk says the beginning, and it's on page 13. So it's not, this is not written by the Chasam Sofer, but it's quoting the Chasam Sofer. So the Pasuk is Ze Yinu Kula Avar Ala Paktim Machsas HaShekel V'Shekel HaKodesh. The Parsha Machsas HaShekel, when instructing Moshe in the proper method by which to count the Jews, God specified that each man was to donate one half shekel coin. God didn't only tell Moshe what it looked like, he actually provided a visual aid. As Rashi said, God showed him the likeness of a fiery coin. Why did the visual aid need to be a fiery coin rather than an ordinary coin? Chasam Sofer explains that it was not the sum of money that was paramount, but the love and fiery passion that motivated the donor. One couldn't simply donate a half shekel in a cold, unemotional manner. In order to truly participate in the tabernacle service, the donation had to be made with a sense of joy and excitement at being able to participate in this wonderful community. Attitude in this case was even more important in the eyes of God than the donation itself. And I think that to end with that is so significant, because if you want to talk about the lasting legacy of the Chasam Sofer, that not only is our community essentially just one of the many, many, many branches of the legacy that he left, but if you want to talk about the greatness of the Chasam Sofer, you have to say one word, and that is passionate. The passion with which he approached everything in life, and that is learning and teaching Torah, caring for his fellow Jews, doing anything to preserve the greatness and the traditions of our Jewish community, that was who he was. He was a passionate individual who cared so deeply about all of these things. If you want to have the main takeaway from who he was, you want to get some lasting lesson of his life, it's incredible, the contributions that he has, and this obviously was just a small excerpt of all that he did for the Jewish community, but the fact that he continued to love so many Jews, the fact that he continued to teach Torah to so many Jews, and still teaches us Torah to this day, shows the incredible passion that he gave us, and that's what we should take from him, to have the same passion for loving our fellow Jews, and also for teaching Torah as well. Again, I apologize for having no voice, but everyone should have a great day.
You did a great job with a bad voice.